WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most miraculous and controversial recent medical breakthroughs was the transplant of a baboon liver to a 35-year-old man. He had hepatitis B, a fatal liver disease. The man died of a stroke September 7th, 10 weeks after the transplant. An ethical debate was focused on the post-mortem revelation that he had HIV. My guest, Dr. Thomas Starzl, directed the team of surgeons who performed the transplant. Dr. Starzl is a pioneer in the field. He performed the first human liver transplantation and the first human kidney transplantation. He was also the first to perform a combined heart-liver transplant. Dr. Starzl has written a memoir called The Puzzle People. That's an expression for people with different transplanted parts. Critics have said it's inappropriate to perform an experimental transplant on a person with the AIDS virus because it takes unfair advantage of their desperation. I asked Dr. Starzl to respond.
Well, I think maybe they have that 180 degrees wrong, or more than that. Our policy here is to treat patients with HIV and to do the best we can for them. So, and we were the first ones that put that policy into effect for transplantation, and then carried it through the Surgeon General, who at that time was Coop, making it a national policy. Now, our policy is to treat HIV patients on the same basis as anyone else, but we can't treat them. They become disqualified for candidacy if they have other serious infections. And of course, the combination of a B virus hepatitis and HIV meant that this particular patient was not a conventional candidate, but he wanted an effort at treatment, and we did the best we could to serve him. But we didn't construe this as an experiment at all, but as an effort to help that specific patient.
As the surgeon, how do you decide who needs a human liver transplant and who has to go with an animal transplant? What's the difference in the medical need?
Well, that issue was discussed very thoroughly with many people and many ethical groups, by the way, going all the way back to last year, to last November. But general decision has been made in many centers, not all of them, that patients who are B virus carriers are basically poor candidates for liver transplantation because they tend to get recurrence of the disease in their new liver.
You mean for human liver transplantation?
This is with human livers. And so more and more, most programs are looking askance at treating those patients with human livers because human livers get reinfected. So that the basic decision was to treat patients with animal organs who had B virus because the baboon is incapable of being infected with this particular virus. So the hypothesis there was that the animal organ would not have this recurrence that has been so common with the use of human organs. And in fact, as far as we can tell, that was what happened. This liver did not become reinfected with the B virus, at least during the nearly 2.5 months of the patient's survival.
What's the next step for you? Do you have your next baboon liver transplant planned, and what will you do different than you did this time around?
Well, we put this on the back burner for the time being because we wanted to get all the facts about the reason for the failure in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a conference up at Columbia University in New York that was sponsored by the New York Academy of Medicine, to which experts from a number of European centers, Sweden, England, Italy, and Germany were invited, as well as experts from around the United States. so that we could get some kind of a consensus for the reason that we failed. And then we presented the autopsy from this case, and the essential conclusion was that there had been a surgical technical problem, a rather subtle one, that caused a partial obstruction of the duct system of this transplanted organ, and that was probably the reason why the case wasn't completely successful. In other words, there was no serious rejection in this organ, and some of the so-called antibody rejection that had brought down all previous attempts at baboon-to-human transplantation had not occurred with this new medication cocktail that we had, and that this liver had not been reinfected with the B virus. So with this information, and now with the possibility of correcting the technical problems that occurred, we think we're in a position to go forward at some time in the fairly near future.
We didn't find out, we meaning the general public, didn't find out that the person who you performed the baboon liver transplant on was HIV positive until after the autopsy. How come that wasn't made public before?
Well, the patient wanted confidentiality, for one thing. And if the patient wants confidentiality, as you know, because you're from Pennsylvania, he's protected by law from the release of information, private medical information. So when the question came up, we didn't confirm or deny it. And the news that he was an HIV carrier didn't come from us in the long run. It was leaked by a variety of people inside the system to reporters who were ravenously hungry for news. And so we didn't confirm or deny this until the event was finished.
Do you think that there might be any applicability of transplant surgery for treating the immune system when it's been infected with the AIDS virus?
That's a distinct possibility. That's an occult consideration in this case, because we really didn't... We set out to treat the patient who was dying of liver failure, and the question you've asked about HIV was a peripheral one, but it was really a rather important one. And some of the observations made in this case, including the fact that cells, white cells, were demonstrated to have left the graft and repopulated around the body of that recipient, go along the lines that you have implied with your question. And the implication, of course, is that you might in some way be able to repopulate the infected white cells in the recipient. Now, if you have so much trouble reinfecting with the B virus, the HIV virus, of course, is just another a virus. And I should add parenthetically that it's been impossible up to the present time to give baboons the HIV-1 virus to infect them or to have seroconversion or to give clinical disease with the HIV-2 virus. So observations along those lines were made in this case.
You did your first human kidney transplant in, it was 1962 or 63?
1962, yes.
Is the patient still alive?
Yes, he is.
What are your memories of that day? I mean, that was a landmark day for you and for medicine.
Well, I can remember almost every detail of that case. We had been so thoroughly prepared for the case that I think we expected to win, and did. I think almost no one else expected that, and so they always thought that I would be as astonished as they were, but we thought we would be able to do this thing, and we were successful.
I know at some point in your work, you decided to stop using living kidney donors. How did you reach that decision?
Well, I became more and more nervous about the donors. We had some close shaves, even as early as 1963, in which, for example, one of our patients developed clots in one of the leg veins, which passed to the lung. And although that patient recovered from that without incident, it could have easily caused the loss of a life. And then I recall another patient in the mid-60s became yellow, developed jaundice after giving a kidney, and that worried us. And then by the end of the 60s, we began to receive reports about donor deaths, always at very good institutions. And I developed this thought that if I ever had a living donor on my conscience, somebody that I had been responsible for who died, that it would really ruin my life. And I couldn't live with that. So I stopped in 1972 and haven't done a living donor for more than 20 years.
Did many other doctors follow suit after you made that decision?
Yes, I think they did. I think many people took that position, but of course many others did not. And I never really tried to influence anybody. In fact, at Pittsburgh, we have one of the best living donor programs, kidney donor programs in the world, and I support it, but I'm not involved in it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Thomas Starzl, and he directed the team of surgeons that recently transplanted a baboon liver to a 35-year-old man with hepatitis. He also performed the very first human liver transplant, and he's written a new memoir called The Puzzle People. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Thomas Starzl. In talking about human experimentation, it just seemed to me from the way you responded to the questions early on in the interview that you prefer to look at this as an attempt to save somebody's life, not an experiment on them.
Yes, I think that was a critical distinction that came up after the Second World War, when there was so much overt human experimentation in Germany and elsewhere. And from the war and that experience came some critical documents that have been guidelines since then. One of them is the Nuremberg Code that came from the Nuremberg trials, and the other was the Helsinki Declaration. Both of those so-called white papers made a distinction between observations made without the objective being the potential good that they would do for the person being studied, or new and innovative procedures that are designed primarily with the hope of helping some individual. And in transplantation, for the most part, or at least all that I've ever been involved in, has concerned this second kind of activity, which is innovative care, in which the beneficiary of the care would be the person that takes the risk. And certainly, of course, the recent patient in Pittsburgh who was dying of liver failure and received an animal organ is a classical example
of just that. How long do you think he would have lived if you didn't perform the transplant?
Well, not very long. He was really extremely ill when we did this. He was sick enough so that he was having periodic cloudiness of his perception of his environment. That is, he was having encephalopathy or brain dysfunction, and he had had a number of bleeds from his intestinal tract, which were caused by his liver disease. And I think he was at the end of the line. He was a bag of water, because that's characteristic of end-stage liver disease. So he did not have long to live, and he had reached the time when he was requiring hospitalization, so that what time was left was not quality time.
Have you ever asked yourself if you were facing death, if you would opt to be the recipient of an organ in an still experimental procedure?
I've asked myself the question. It's impossible to answer, because if you're not facing death, you really can't weigh that option.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I know when I was younger, of course, I'm quite withered up and pretty much a spent squid at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was younger, I'm pretty sure I would go the whole nine yards.
One of the things that really surprised me in reading your memoir, The Puzzle People, is that you've always really, well, kind of hated performing surgery.
Well, I never did enjoy it very much. It seemed like it was too stressful. And then I think the fear of failing was always there. But I managed to get through it for quite a long time. But it's quite a relief not to be involved in the technical aspects of surgery any longer.
Do you think it's uncommon for a doctor to really dislike and be that nervous about performing surgery?
Well, I have the impression it is uncommon, because a lot of people that I know feel that their only real tranquility is in the operating room. And they see it in a different way, almost opposite of what I described. My only torment was in the operating room, and the only tranquility was outside of it. So I think I had this thing turned around for quite a number of years. But it had its advantages, too, because the some of the struggles and failures left an imprint that served as a roadmap for the next steps. And I think if you're casual about it, it's too easy to rationalize and forget failures. And I really wasn't able to do that. So I learned from failures more than most people might have.
What do you consider one of your terrible failures, but at least you really learned something from it?
Well, I suppose the most crushing failure I ever had was having Benny Solis bleed to death under my hands. That was the first liver transplant that was ever tried on the 1st of March, 1963. And we were not able to save him, and we were not even able to get him through the operation. So I never was able to sweep that under the rug, and it became a burning memory from that time onward.
Do you ever worry about the possibility of bringing animal diseases to humans by transplanting animal organs into human bodies? Is that a possibility?
Well, yes, I think it's a possibility, and of course we worry about it, but took elaborate precautions to prevent that by doing infectious disease screening in the donors that were considered for this recent case, and also for the animal donors that were used nearly 30 years ago. So the answer is that it's possible, and when something is possible, it also is preventable. I think it's easier to do a more complete survey of that kind with animals in whom you can plan everything ahead than it is with the use of cadaver organs, where you really frequently have no warning that some kind of a disaster is going to befall the donor. So the knowledge base for any animal donor is going to be very much greater and more complete than it is with a cadaver human donor.
But you think that you can control the spread of viruses by being careful and by screening?
Well, I think so, sure, yeah. Because the diseases that are that potentially would jump across species, as well as the diseases that resist jumping across species, I think are pretty well known. There would have to be a surprise.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Starzl, I know that you were not too long ago. You underwent surgery yourself. You had a heart bypass surgery. What kind of patient were you?
I was a tremendously vigorous patient and also quite non-compliant. I got the job done. Also, I was quite good for society because I didn't cost them much because I got out of the hospital so fast. But I only stayed in for a couple of days and then left against the advice of my doctors, who sent the police after me one morning.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. Well, yes, after a couple of days, I went down and had a cup of coffee and a donut at my favorite place a couple blocks away, and the next thing I knew, the police came and took me back. But I really wanted to get home and get away from the hospital and feeling that I could recover better, and that's what happened.
I mean, what does that say about our hospitals that you wanted to get out so badly? Or do you think that's just human nature?
Oh, I think it's human nature. I think it's human nature. Hospitals are wonderful places, but they're not places where you would go for recreation or anything like that. I wanted to be at home.
Well, Dr. Starzl, thank you for sharing some of your time with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Thomas Starzl directs the Transplantation Institute at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. His new memoir is called The Puzzle People. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.